How much more American blood must we shed before Congress does its job?
Much of what we heard from President Trump throughout this senseless shutdown has been full of misinformation and even malice.
We don't govern by temper tantrum.
Imagine if it was your child, your husband, or your wife.
Manufacturing a crisis.
At the request of Democrats, it will be a steel barrier rather than a concrete wall.
The women and children at the border are not a security threat.
So sad, so terrible.
How do we untangle this mess?
President Trump must stop holding the American people hostage.
Treated as leverage.
Call Congress and tell them to finally, after all of these decades, secure our border.
Reopen the government.
End this shutdown now.
Thank you and good night.
Televised political theater and no end in sight. Meanwhile, it's day 19 of the partial government shutdown, and government employees across the country continue to go without pay. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In the week before Christmas, Sarah Ferris at Politico asked Republican Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania about the impact of the shutdown on federal employees. His response?
You know, who's living that they're not going to make it to the next paycheck?
A lot of people.
But you got to plan a little bit, right?
Well, here's what some of those federal employees told us. From Chicago, Illinois, my spouse and I have stopped searching to buy our first house, and we're using our down payment to pay the bills.
My name is Monica from Lebanon, Oregon. My husband, a member of the Air Force and an HPSP student, did end up getting paid on January 1st. I've been doing some research to see if we will continue to be paid as usual because the Department of Defense is apparently funded through September 2019, but I'm getting conflicting information about how things will work out as the shutdown continues. The time has also arrived to register for board examinations, which require an upfront payment of over $1,000, and we're concerned that reimbursement will take even longer than usual as things are getting continuously behind.
And the reality extends far beyond government employees. 4 in 10 adults say they could not produce $400 in an emergency without sliding into debt or selling something. That's according to 2017 figures. And a lot of you, our listeners, are feeling the same.
My name is Alex. I'm in Oklahoma City. I live paycheck to paycheck and hope for the best. My VA benefits provide enough of a cushion that I won't go homeless or hungry, but my debt-to-income ratio is so high that if I lose my job, I'll instantly be forced to file bankruptcy.
Hi, this is Shane McManus. I'm calling from Morgantown, West Virginia. Here in Morgantown, we are way below the national average in terms of the minimum wage for people my age. I'm 30 years old, and I personally am going from paycheck to paycheck. If I'm lucky and I have a family that I have to support, I don't think President Trump really understands what the average American goes through.
Harry Holzer is with us. He's a professor of public policy at Georgetown and former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. It's good to have you back with us, Harry.
Nice to be back.
Let's start where what we're told when it comes to savings. I mean, we hear this thing about on average, you should have a 6-month emergency fund. Is that realistic?
Well, most people happen to not even come close to that number. The average cash savings by American families, and here I'm not including retirement funds, 401ks, or the value of your home. The average cash savings is about $4,000. That's the median. If the median is $4,000, that means a whole lot of people have much less than that.
I want to talk a little bit about why that is, but you mentioned retirement accounts. What about in that area? I know a lot of those accounts are accounts that you can't pull on necessarily, and if you do, you get penalized if you pull on them too early. But what are those accounts looking like for Americans?
Well, people do have more money in those accounts, but there again, people below average income, below middle class income, often have very little in those accounts, if they have any at all. And of course, younger workers, people in their 20s, their 30s, maybe just starting a family, they tend to have very little money in those accounts as well. Savings are something that take many, many years to accumulate.
One of the things that's always been interesting to me is the difference between how income and wealth influence this conversation. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, I guess the question I'm trying to get at is, why do so few Americans have enough cash savings?
One of the issues is that certainly savings is related to people's incomes. And Americans like to consume. They like to spend their money. There's lots of things we have to spend our money on. And incomes have really stagnated for Americans over several decades now, except at the top, except for the top 10, 20%. So people's incomes have not grown enough to give them room to save. And really what you find is that, you know, savings do grow with people's incomes, but they grow fairly modestly until you get to that top end, until you get to the sort of 20, 25% range, and then they really start taking off. Then people have enough money to live their lifestyles and still put away.
In the introduction, we mentioned Scott Perry, who is a Republican congressman of Pennsylvania, and was asked by a reporter, you know, what can families do who don't have this savings? And Perry basically said, you know, people have got to plan a little bit. And I've seen this also come up in social media where, you know, people are sort of commenting on the fact that federal employees should have planned better or should have some money in savings. That doesn't seem to be realistic, Harry. I mean, are people at this point, when they don't have the money, what do they do? Are they turning to credit cards? Are we getting further in debt?
Yes, I would think that borrowing of one type or another is what they fall back on primarily. Now, again, to get formal loans from a bank, you have to have good credit ratings, and a lot of these folks don't have that. Yeah, so they might pile up some credit card debt, and my guess is that they also turn to family and close friends for assistance. You know, whether it's cash assistance or help us out with childcare or something like that to try to get through these times.
What do you make of that idea that that Americans just should have saved, that these folks should have just planned better? It feels slightly cavalier to me to assume that when the savings rate is as low as it is.
Well, it is cavalier. It is cavalier. And, you know, maybe that congressman should be more critical of this ridiculous shutdown, which is causing these people the financial hardship, rather than criticizing the people themselves. And again, I do favor a set of efforts to try to nudge Americans to save more, to plan ahead, you know, financial literacy, financial education, other savings incentives. Having said that, when incomes for folks have been low or stagnating for decades, that's a problem too, and that's going to feed this problem. So it's terribly cavalier for the congressman to so easily dismiss people's hardship. And while I favor efforts to get people to save more, let's be a little more sensitive and try to alleviate their hardship.
You know, there have been more than 20 federal government shutdowns, partial or complete, in the past 40 years. And these federal jobs have long been considered good jobs. I mean, this was the type of job that someone was supposed to get and would stay with for 20 years, 30 years, and get a good pension. And are these jobs, is this an indication that these jobs are no longer the golden egg, I think, that many people thought they might have been?
Well, that's true to some extent, because increasingly you see these jobs contracted out to private firms acting as contractors. And in those cases, the jobs are not necessarily as good. The wages may not be as high. The benefits may not be as strong. So to that extent, to the extent that folks work for contractors, they're not as good as they were. But even someone in a good public job, a public job that might be better than their private sector counterpart, if the pay isn't that high, or if people are still young. Now, again, remember, people in their 20s, their 30s often have not had time to lay away any serious cash. You know, they have to pay off the debt they're piling up when they're getting educated. They might be trying to buy a home and have to put down a down payment. So there's lots of reasons why people in their 20s and 30s, even if they have decent jobs, may not have accumulated many assets yet, especially cash savings.
What does all this mean for the economy as a whole? When Americans can't save the level that they need to or should be saving, when a lot of Americans, and not just federal employees, but we're hearing from a lot of Americans who say they're living paycheck to paycheck, what does that do to our economy? Which, by the way, we keep hearing unemployment is low, you know, these are good, booming economy, but yet Americans are living paycheck to paycheck.
That's right. I mean, A, it shows up as a problem in circumstances like this, where something goes wrong and people can't work. The last time there was a lot of attention on this in the media was actually during Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, where a lot of people were caught off guard. They couldn't use their cars. They couldn't stay in their homes. And yet they had no money to travel to a different city, to stay in a hotel, et cetera, which is why so many people, you know, crammed into that awful sports arena. But so when things go bad, they can feel the lack of savings. But it's really more of a long-term problem for a lot of people. Your assets don't grow over time if you haven't been putting money away. So when it gets time to send your kid to college, there may be too little money to finance that. In other ways, having assets gives people some upward mobility, enables them to move ahead. And so people without those assets are going to have more trouble doing that.
I always say, Harry, it takes money to make money, really.
Well, that's right. That's right. Or at least it does take some savings out of the money you have. So we know, that, for instance, whether or not kids can go to college often depends on how much their parents have put away. You know, and of course, for the economy overall, it's not such a great thing to have such a low savings rate because it's harder to accumulate capital, which is good for the economy. And we have a debt problem in America at all levels, right? We have households have a bit of a debt problem, companies have a debt problem, and the federal government has an enormous debt problem. So the lack of household savings to me is a piece of a larger picture. Where Americans have trouble accumulating the assets they need over time.
What can they do? What can we all do better to save more?
First of all, I do think financial literacy and financial education is something important that people should get fairly early in life. I think there are things that the federal government can do to make it easier for people to save. For instance, you know, trying to encourage everybody to have a 401k where they work and make that the default option for people, not something that they have to choose. There are incentives, you know, government matching can be done, especially for low-income people when they put money away. So there's things that we can do to nudge people to do more saving. And of course, it would be very nice if people's incomes start rising again, and you know, especially for non-college educated workers. And there's a whole policy agenda on that side that we could talk about, better education, better quality jobs, et cetera, that would certainly help as well.
Harry Holzer is a professor of public policy at Georgetown and former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. Harry, thank you as always.
Thank you, Tanzina.
My husband works for Social Security. This time around, I think he'll still get his paycheck this Friday for the previous 2 weeks because they keep saying that it's a partial shutdown. We have retirement savings, but we happen to have our taxes from last year. I just haven't used it up, so we'll be okay. But if it continues into the next paycheck after this Friday, you know, things will be a hassle. We won't, you know, have enough for that. My name is Jennifer, Northern California.
My name is Jordan. I'm calling from the Dallas, Oregon. I bought a house earlier in the year, and it has wiped out my savings for the down payment. I'm trying to be frugal and rebuild it as fast as possible because currently I can maybe survive 1 month without pay or with a small medical emergency, but it is very stressful to be in such a precarious position.
Hi, this is Brian from Chester County, Pennsylvania. The shutdown has negatively impacted our family. I'm a residential real estate appraiser and have seen FHA mortgage appraisals slow over the last few weeks.
Call us with your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And while you're on Twitter, check out our poll. We want to know, how much money do you have saved for an emergency or sudden job loss? Tell us on Twitter. Again, we're at The Takeaway. Loitering, trespassing, petty theft. Commit one of these low-level crimes and you might be charged with a misdemeanor.
Misdemeanor is a minor offense. Usually the term means that you cannot be sentenced to more than 1 year of incarceration.
That's Alexandra Notopoff, a professor of law at the University of California, Irvine. And she says that about 13 million misdemeanor cases are filed every year in the United States. That's compared with just 3 or 4 million felony cases.
It's an enormous world of low-level offenses of low-level conduct, and it represents about 80% of American criminal dockets. It's pretty much what the American criminal system does most of the time.
And yet, Nadipov says the system is deeply unfair, and there's not much public discussion about it. She's the author of the new book, Punishment Without Crime: How Our Massive Misdemeanor System Traps the Innocent and Makes America More Unequal. In it, Nadipov argues that we need to start paying attention to how misdemeanors impact our country now.
It's a way that the American criminal system operates that, that we just haven't paid attention to, and yet it's so influential. It touches so many lives and so many families. It's a very sloppy system. Laws are often ignored. People are not getting lawyers. It's very fast. People are often swept through the system in ways that we just don't see in serious cases. And because it's so influential and yet so sloppy, it does all kinds of work that I don't think that we really appreciate the implications of it. It's criminalizing millions of people. It disproportionately touches the poor, people of color, stripping people of their wealth. It takes a lot of money from people. It locks people up all the time. It's just an incredibly powerful state apparatus.
So you were previously a public defender in Baltimore. Can you give us an example of what you witnessed and how the system operates unfairly?
I want to tell you a story that I tell in the book because I think it's so important and hasn't gotten the kind of attention that it deserves. Baltimore police are kind of locally famous for using loitering as a way of clearing corners. They round people up, they arrest them for loitering, and those folks end up in the criminal system. Turns out that by law, it's kind of difficult to loiter in Baltimore. It requires impeding the free flow of vehicular or pedestrian traffic. That's what Baltimore law says. And the courts in Maryland have said, most of the time when people are arrested for loitering, they're probably not actually loitering. And so what that means is these people who are being locked up, incarcerated, having pressure put on them to plead guilty, often because they can't make bail, that means they're probably pleading guilty to a crime that they did not commit. And that phenomenon of people getting swept through the system and being pressured to plead guilty, particularly in these low-level offenses, generated an enormous amount of injustice, wrongful convictions, in ways that I think we really need to be paying attention to.
Are those misdemeanor convictions correlated to quotas that police have to fill?
One of the things that police tell us and that we are starting to learn about misdemeanor policing and misdemeanor processing is that many police officers feel under pressure, either formally or informally, from their departments to produce misdemeanor arrests and citations. It's a way of measuring productivity. And what they tell us is it forces them to make arrests or issue citations that they wouldn't otherwise make. That's a way of saying that police officers don't necessarily feel that there is enough evidence to bring this person in or to charge them with a crime. And that's the beginning of the process. It's the beginning of the net, if you will, that sweeps people in. And so one of the recommendations I make in the book, and I'm not alone in this, many organizations have called for the elimination of this pressure on police officers to meet a quota, to meet a certain number, to prove that they're doing their jobs. It's not a good measure of good policing.
What about when it comes to money? I'm thinking back to Ferguson, Missouri, for example, around the time that Michael Brown was killed, and the reporting that came out of that also showed that there were a disproportionate number of Black residents of that community and surrounding communities who had essentially been targeted for traffic violations. And ultimately, those tickets were then paid off and in many ways used as a revenue generator. Are misdemeanors a revenue generator for police departments or states or cities?
It would be hard to overstate the importance of money in driving and in many ways distorting the misdemeanor system. As you just pointed out, often people end up in jail or end up facing misdemeanor charges precisely because they cannot afford to pay a fine or a fee. They can't afford to pay a traffic ticket. They can't afford to pay the registration on their car. We have criminalized that form of poverty and turned it in effect, into a basis for imposing misdemeanors. People do time when they fail to pay their fines and fees, so they may not be sentenced to jail up front, but jail is always lurking in the background as a kind of a threat to low-income people, to working people, to poor people, if they can't pay those fines and fees. We're just starting to appreciate the impact of bail, cash bail, which is effectively incarcerates people who can't afford to pay even very what might seem to be low levels of bail, a few hundred dollars. That's a lot of money for a lot of people. And then again, as you mentioned, there are reasons, there are institutional reasons why the criminal system has turned to fines and fees and bail in this way, because so many of the institutions rely on that revenue stream, courts and probation offices, public defender office, prosecutor offices. So it's an enormous world of wealth stripping, regressive, effective taxation. We're taking the money from vulnerable people in the criminal system to fund and run the criminal system itself.
I imagine you see racial disparities in these numbers as well.
The misdemeanor system, I think, has not gotten its fair share of blame for the ways that it has racialized crime in this country. It's the first great threat to racial equality in our criminal system. That net, that misdemeanor net, is the first moment when people of color are disproportionately swept into the criminal system. They're disproportionately arrested for low-level offenses like trespassing, loitering, like the Baltimore example I mentioned earlier, jaywalking. That's the first moment that the criminal system goes after people of color in a disproportionate way, and it shapes every subsequent step of the system.
Ultimately, what are you hoping to accomplish with this book?
I'm really hoping to accomplish two things. So the first is the misdemeanor system is an incredibly important public institution. We need a low-level criminal system that works well and fairly and according to law. And my hope that is that this book will help people understand this public institution that hasn't gotten enough attention and give us ways to understand how we might improve it and improve its integrity. But the other hope is really, in a way, a deeper hope. We need to rethink what we mean by the term criminal when we call people criminals. Because for millions of Americans in this country who are swept into the misdemeanor system and who get a criminal conviction, they really haven't done anything bad. They haven't done anything harmful. They haven't even done anything that we might think is wrong. In 25 states, speeding is a misdemeanor. We label so many things crimes and we sweep in so many people. I think we need to rethink, what does it mean that we label people criminals, and we need to back off that harsh and dehumanizing approach.
Alexandra Nadipoff is a professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, and author of the new book, Punishment Without Crime, How Our Massive Misdemeanor System Traps the Innocent and Makes America More Unequal. Alexandra, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm not leaving my room until I see UNHCR. I want asylum.
18-year-old Rahaf Mohammed Al-Kunun fled her home country of Saudi Arabia last weekend. Al-Kunun is seeking refuge from her family, who she says threatened to torture and kill her for leaving the Muslim faith. She's since been given refugee status by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. After leaving Saudi Arabia on a flight to Thailand, Al-Kunun's story went viral on social media as she began tweeting her standoff with Thai immigration officials from inside an airport hotel room. But Al-Kunun is not alone. The Saudi government estimates 577 women attempted to flee their homes in 2015, but that number is likely much higher. Sara Aziza is a journalist covering human rights and women's issues in the Middle East, and her most recent reporting is with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Sara, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about Rahaf, who we heard at the top of the segment. Tell us more about the specifics in her deciding to flee from her family.
Sure. So according to Rahaf's own testimony, she was facing domestic abuse physically, psychologically at home. And then she also cited just the general oppressive atmosphere inside Saudi Arabia. She actually renounced Islam, which is not what every female asylum seeker chooses to do, but she also said that she saw the religion as an oppressive force in her life. And that is a very dangerous statement to make as well. So she said that she wanted an education, a career, and a future, and felt like that was impossible in Saudi Arabia.
You know, you've been doing a lot of reporting on people who are fleeing Saudi Arabia in particular. Your latest work is focusing on women. Tell us about what we're seeing more broadly. What are the dangers that women are facing in the country?
Again, domestic violence is a very big issue there. It's vastly underreported. I interviewed many women who were facing domestic abuse at the hands of their fathers, uncles, even brothers. Actually, Rahaf was fearful of her brother as well as her father taking revenge on her if she should be deported back to Saudi Arabia. So brothers can also play a big role. And then one of the reasons that violence in the home is so prevalent is because women have very little recourse. The laws have only recently come to criminalize domestic abuse at all. And practically speaking, it's very unlikely that women are going to get help. I've spoken to many women in Saudi Arabia and then asylum seekers abroad who report trying to seek help. Women are often blamed or just face worse abuse after being rebuffed by the authorities. So it's really a pretty dire situation. And this is all sort of bolstered and supported by the Saudi guardianship system, which we've been hearing a lot about with Rahaf's case, which renders women legal minors in Saudi Arabia. So women are subject throughout their lives until the day they die. They are under the authority of their male guardian, which could be a father, uncle, husband, even a son. So we can see a woman in their 60s maybe who might be unmarried or widowed and be subject to the will of her teenage son, for example, for many legal and social services.
With that as the backdrop, what's interesting, I think, is that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, has been in some ways painted as this progressive reformer of the country, particularly when it comes to women, right? Mm-hmm. We've heard that Saudi women can now drive, which was a huge deal. You mentioned this law that, you know, is supposed to protect or give women recourse for, you know, who are facing domestic violence. What's the reality in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's undoubtable that some women do enjoy more freedom and more opportunity than they have in the past. Some women have really supportive, loving families, and they're able to get that education, get that job, now get behind the wheel of a car. But it really speaks to sort of the place we began when being allowed to drive a car is, you know, this huge milestone for women. Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, as many of us call him in the media now, granted the right to drive at the same time as locking up women who dared to speak publicly about the need for greater equality, the need to dismantle the guardianship system, as I mentioned. And practically speaking, many women don't see much of a difference at all in their day-to-day lives because really a lot of the decisions are made within the home by the husband, the father, and, you know, influential male relatives. And even when the laws are beginning to shift a little bit as far as what women could theoretically be able to accomplish, practically speaking, judges, police, authority figures tend to still defer to whatever male authority figure might be present in the woman's life. And so it really comes down to not who's the crown prince, but who's your father or husband. And there are still many people who adhere to really regressive ideas of what a woman's role should be.
And given that backdrop as well, you said women can't get passports. How do women flee Saudi Arabia? I mean, the logistics of that and what you're describing is very structural. Mm-hmm. How are women able to get out? What are the actual logistics of doing that?
It's really quite a daring and risky thing to try and escape Saudi Arabia. I actually have a piece coming out in The New Yorker this week that describes the journey of several women who fled Saudi Arabia to Europe. And in their stories, sort of, we describe the logistics of how they pulled that off. So women will need to either get a passport through the wali or guardian, whether it's in Rahaf's case, when the family travels together abroad, the father will, you know, sort of see that as, okay, a reason to grant his daughter a passport. Other women are stealing their father's phones and using an app. The Ministry of Interior in Saudi Arabia has a popular app called Abshir that most men have on their phones. So women describe stealing their father's phones, hacking into them. They're able from there to log on to the Ministry of Interior and impersonate their fathers and issue themselves the paperwork to get travel permission or passports.
What happens to many of these women after they flee?
Well, for those who do make it out, and many are stopped at the airport, many are apprehended or intercepted in Rahaf's case. There was another woman just last year who was intercepted in the Philippines, Dina Ali Laslum. So many women don't make it. But those who do, it depends on where they land and the asylum laws of that country. So Australia is a popular destination. That's where Rahaf was going. A few other places in Western Europe. So if they're able to, you know, sort of begin asylum proceedings there, it varies from country to country. But what's pretty universal and pretty tragic is many of them have to look forward to a life without any family connections, without ever going back to their home country. I spoke to many women who really broke down talking about how much they miss their mothers or little brothers, how much it hurts that their friends are afraid to talk to them. A lot of family and friends do face government interrogation in suspicion that they might have helped these women escape. So it's really quite a drastic and brave thing for any of these women to attempt. They're incredibly courageous, and it really speaks to what they're facing back home that they're willing to pay such a price.
Sarah Aziza is a journalist covering human rights and women's issues in the Middle East, and she has a piece on Saudi women coming out in The New Yorker this week. Sarah, thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, that's all we have time for today, but we'll be back with you tomorrow. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway or tweet me at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.